Welcome to High Impact Growth, a podcast from Damagi about the role of technology in creating a world where everyone has access to the services they need to thrive. I'm Amy Vaccaro, Senior Director of Marketing at Damagi and your co-host, along with Jonathan Jackson, Damagi's CEO and co-founder. Today, Jonathan and I have the honor to speak with Dr. Madeline Ballard, co-founder and CEO of the Community Health Impact Coalition. Dr. Ballard has spent her entire career focused on how to create health for all, and has honed in on the fact that community health workers, well, they work, in a world where 1 billion people will never reach a healthcare provider. Community health workers hold incredible potential to expand access to care and deliver better and more equitable health outcomes, but they are shockingly unsupported. The Community Health Impact Coalition, or CHIC as it's referred to, is working to make professional community health workers the norm, which means getting them salaried, skilled, supervised, and supplied. On this podcast, you've heard from a number of community health workers. We heard from Margaret O'Dara most recently, who's leading a movement of community health workers in alignment with CHIC. We've also heard from Maruka, Jared, and Lawrence, three community health workers who are supported by Luwala Community Alliance. Today's conversation builds on those conversations, and you're going to hear from someone who's working at the research, advocacy, and activation level, working to support community health workers and advocate for better jobs for these incredibly important frontline health workers. Today, you're going to find out what leading countries are doing to professionalize community health workers, including a closer look at what's unfolding today in Kenya that you started to learn about from Margaret O'Dara previously. You're going to hear about why this matters so much and what it means for technologists and funders who want to create a world where everyone has access to the services they need to thrive. Enjoy. All right. Welcome to the podcast. So I am so excited for today's conversation. Jonathan Jackson and I are here with Dr. Madeline Ballard. Welcome, Madeline. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So we've got a lot of questions for you, and I'm excited to really dig in, but I'd love to hear, start with a little bit about your story and your background, and how did you get into this work of leading the Community Health Impact Coalition?
Sure. I think it's pretty simple, really. I think, you know, we all know how it feels to be sick. A lot of us have been lucky enough to access adequate healthcare. We've needed it. And my story is really that. I grew up in Canada where health was a right. And then suddenly, at 18 years old, I found myself living in a country unnamed, but right next door, where it wasn't. And in the tumult of my transition to adulthood, in that period when everything, I think, was getting a little bit grayer, more complex, the right to health kind of stood out as a really rare and compelling area of moral clarity. Particularly at that time, I was connected with HIV activists. There was still a waiting list for HIV drugs in the United States at that time. And that felt absurd to me. You know, you take an antiretroviral pill, you live a long and happy life. And if you don't, you die. And obviously a lot has changed since I was 18 years old, but that sort of sense of intense moral clarity kind of remains with me. And community health workers were obviously kind of the pioneers of the HIV movement and have been kind of proven again and again in a number of disease areas to be just the best way to get care to everyone, to the poor, the rural, the stigmatized in cities, the underserved. And so, and yet we're in this place where their labor gets taken advantage of and their own health is not a priority. And so, yeah, I was just compelled to kind of keep working with these folks and ensure that the fantastic work that they're doing, and that as they advocate for their patients, that there's folks also advocating with them for their own salaries, skills, supervision, supplies. We know how to make that happen.
That's wonderful. And I think, Madeline, you have had lots of champions with the work that the coalition does. And I would love for you to share with the audience just more about the Community Health Impact Coalition, how it came to be, and what its priorities and goals are currently.
Sure. Well, I mean, it really emerged from that dilemma that I just described, right? You have millions of community health workers who are not salaried, skilled, supervised, and supplied. I think that's surprising to a lot of folks. You tell them, hey, you know, 80%+ of the community health workers in the continent of Africa are unsalaried. And folks are bewildered by that. They say, how could that happen? And then you say, well, 70% of them are women. You know, there hasn't historically been an organization of community health workers. So this idea of they haven't been at the table. And so as we know, that means you're on the menu. Over many decades, there's been this dual-sided human rights issue that's emerged where you have CHWs both being exploited from a labor perspective and then less effective for patients. If you're out of stock a third of the time, you're not exactly bringing it when it comes to malaria, diarrhea, pneumonia, all these really common cause of illness and death in our world. So, and that's really important because, as you know, you talked about before, Jonathan, you know, there's 1 billion people who are never going to see a health worker in our world. And so we want to make sure that that coverage is there. And then when folks are in contact with health workers, that experience is excellent and the community health workers are supported to deliver the fantastic care that we know that they can provide. So Community Health Impact Coalition is comprised of and for CHWs. We are CHWs, aligned health organizations in about 40 countries who are trying to make professional community health workers the norm by changing guidelines, funding, and policy. And by professional, I really just mean salaried, skilled, supervised, supplied, what you would expect from any type of job for any type of health worker, but just what isn't the case here. And so we do 3 things together. We do research to kind of equip international norm setters with the evidence to sort of create the health guidance that is used for issues of health when designing care in their countries. We obviously do a bunch of advocacy together, specifically around influencing global financing institutions to increase the amount of money allocated for professional CHWs and close what is right now a multi-billion dollar financing gap. And then third, we mobilize in-country networks of CHWs to win national, you know, professional CHW policy. And if there was kind of a sentence about CHIC, it would just be, you know, we exist because CHWs work. There's a double entendre there. You know, they reduce the amount of sickness and death in the community, and they do that by really busting their humps. And so how do we make sure that as we march towards care for all, that includes those who provide it?
I love that tagline. And we've talked at length on this podcast, but also DeMonte's existed for the last 20 years, specifically with CHWs as one of our biggest user bases, and it's currently the biggest. And I think the notion of making sure that they have the basic skills, supervision, payment, and supplies they need, as you said, anybody in any job would expect these things. And CHWs are some of the most proven, cost-effective health interventions we have. And you mentioned the 1 billion people who will not reach a healthcare provider, but for plenty of other billions who do reach healthcare providers, the healthcare ecosystem in many countries has become extremely transactional, right? And so it's not just that CHWs are effective at improving health outcomes, they're creating human connection and empathy and being a true accompanying tour of a lot of sick patients, households, people going through extremely challenging circumstances. And that's also something that is kind of not even factored in when we talk about how cost-effective and how valuable these CHW programs can be when we say they work. And so totally agree. And I think that there's so many other benefits too, on top of the proven benefits, which alone, you know, demonstrate the ROI of investing in CHW programs, but so many others as well. And as you think about those 3 pillars that you're doing, where are you seeing, you know, exciting progress? There has been a lot of great movement in some areas, but where are you also feeling barriers to achieving this vision?
If you are listening along and you go to Google right now and you search CHIC, CHIC policy dashboard, you'll see a beta version of kind of what it would look like to track progress across this field. It's basically a map that summarizes CHW policy across the 137 countdown countries. And it's something that we're building together as a field. And to your point, Jonathan, about barriers, you'll see that only 34 of 137 countries are currently accrediting and paying CHWs. So the barriers are real. For a program to succeed on a national scale, you need the political will, you need financing, you need good system design implementation, and that's not easy. At the same time, when we think about progress, the good news is that map is actually changing very rapidly. You have countries like Ethiopia that have long had a national professional CHW cadre, but they're quickly being joined by others. You know, in the last 5 years, you know, Liberia, Malawi have created professional CHWs cadres. You had Margaret Adera from Kenya on the podcast in May of this year. And as we speak, Kenya is literally, through the efforts of community health workers like her, creating a national pro CHW cadre after demonstration after demonstration after demonstration and county after county. So I think I'd say 2 things. If you're listening from a country that accredits and pays CHWs, that's purple on that dashboard, on that map, you might be thinking, well, you know, our health system is pretty imperfect. We don't really have a ton to teach folks. And I think what I'd say is that's incorrect. You know, if you're in one of those countries, recognize that you're actually on the vanguard of what is a global movement, a movement that's expanding rapidly, and a movement that really requires you to be a people of invitation, people who say, hey, you know, come and see, we're doing this. And I think if you're listening from a place that's not from the Purple Gang or not about to join the Purple Gang, like Kenya, I'd say look at that map, because what you'll see are countries that pay and accredit CHWs that are poorer than yours, that are more unstable, that share the particular regional challenges of the place where you live or where you work. And so, you know, are there ways to find people from those places and sort of say, how do you do it? You know, how can we join in? And I think that's what looking at problems from a field level view gives the opportunity to do.
This movement to salary, supervise, supply, and support community health workers, I think that's just so crisp. Is there a country where you can kind of describe, like, what does this look like in practice? Like, what is it moving from and to? And I know one of the things that I love about your work as Sheikh is that you're traveling around and you're meeting with community health workers and you're really in the trenches with them to help inform policy work that you're doing. So is there maybe a country or a story that you could tell that kind of illustrates, like, what does that movement look like? Where is it starting? What does a day-to-day look like for a community health worker today versus once they kind of implement some of these policies?
Sure. So let's tell the unfolding story of Kenya, and maybe we can conclude it where we hope it'll conclude. We have a country, I mean, it's a very decentralized health system, first of all, so there's not one national policy. There's each county has its own policy, but let's just pick one county and pretend like that's a metaphor for the whole country. What you have are folks called community health volunteers, and community health volunteers are doing tons of work. They're doing promotive work, right? They're doing health talks, connecting folks in rural areas or urban areas to essential information. They're doing preventative work. They're screening children for all sorts of conditions, making sure they've had their vaccinations, maybe doing something as complex as screening a whole population for eyeglasses. And then they're doing curative care in Rwanda. CHWs cure half of all malaria cases are treated right there in the community on the doorstep. And we see a trajectory whereby the more community health workers are supported, the more of that caseload that they can take on. So they're getting care to people who've never had it or closer to folks to whom it was previously maybe a 48-hour walk through a dense rainforest jungle to get to. But in a lot of counties in Kenya, and again, in a lot of countries in Africa, those community health workers are maybe getting, they're out of stock up to a third of the time, which is not a problem with the supply chain, because often the health centers to whom they're attached are out of stock maybe only 10% of the time. So it's really a gap between them being recognized as part of that supply chain. So they don't have the tools that they need, which is frustrating for them. It's frustrating for their patients. They are not getting the latest training that they need. So maybe they saw a USAID PowerPoint 10 years ago, and they were told someone was going to come supervise them and coach them, but kind of no one ever came. The backpack's worn out, the supplies are empty, and kind of what next? And that's what they're asking. They're hungry for knowledge, not able to get it. And again, they're often, it's not the supervisor's fault often, because that supervisor is potentially and frequently a nurse at a clinic who has her own full-time and half job. So how is she supposed to be in two places at once, you know, on a motorbike, going to remote villages or even just different areas of town, city, and supervising and coaching health worker work as well? She's also supposed to be seeing patients at the facility. So the community health workers are often really left high and dry, and adding insult to all this injury is, yeah, they're often unsalaried. And the only potential quote unquote encouragement that they get in their role is maybe they get a pair of gumboots or maybe sometimes some little tiny financial incentives related to vertical disease campaigns. For example, if a team is coming through to vaccinate children and they help mobilize the community, they might get a little token of appreciation for that. But in the meantime, they're there day in, day out. They're the one being called at 2 a.m. when something goes wrong, when a child is sick, and it's just not sustainable. And what ends up happening is either there's no care in the community, because the healthcare worker needs to go find an income source somewhere else, or, and it's usually kind of a mix of both, that healthcare worker is devoting hours and hours and hours to this, working under terrible conditions, providing lower quality care than we know that they're able to provide, and coming home at the end of the day. I mean, I was just with Margaret in Nairobi, and one of her colleagues was saying at a big national meeting, she was saying, listen, you know, my kids are confused because they know mom works, but they also know, you know, mom can't pay their school fees. So what's going on here? And I think we want to go from that situation, which is quite common, to a new vision where we support junior health workers perform like the professionals that they are. And I think this is something that's intuitive to most people. If you had a factory and you didn't pay the workers, you didn't supervise the workers, you didn't supply the workers, you know, what type of product would you get? Probably a pretty crummy one. I think that's what we see with healthcare in a lot of places. And we know that this is just not optional, whether it's your angle is pandemic preparedness, whether your angle is, you know, youth employment or rural employment or women's empowerment, just pure financial return on investment. It's not just the right thing to do. It's a smart thing to do to make that investment. And that's why I think what we see more and more countries like Kenya making that shift, saying, hey, actually, we've experimented with this. It's not getting us the results that we need. And we know that if we just make minor investments to bring community workers into supply chains, they have the tools that they need. We invest in some coaches for them, like any other employee. We make sure that they're on payroll and it's expanding the wage bill is always contentious, but it's possible and down in country after country. Then the dividends that we're going to reap will far exceed that initial investment, just in terms of these dramatic reductions that you can see in death and in sickness, in women, in children, across the board.
Thank you so much for painting that picture for us. And it's fascinating to hear you describe it because it feels improbable on both sides, right? Like even having spoken with Margaret in depth, it's like I hear the situation that community health workers are in and I'm like, why would you stay in a job that's not paying you or supporting you and is probably incredibly stressful, right? Because you're getting calls from people that need help and you're not able to help everyone to the best of your capacity. You haven't been even trained to do all the things that you probably need to do. So on the kind of worker side, it seems improbable. And then on the government side too, it just seems like it makes no sense to me. And so I'm curious if you could unpack for me a little bit of, from your perspective of having, you know, worked across countries and across programs, like if you have any visibility on the why of both sides of this wild equation.
Absolutely. I think it starts with us considering the concept of choice. And I think we asked that question, right? Like, why would Margaret choose to work without pay? That's a weird choice. And I think it's a weird choice until we contextualize it. And in a context of high unemployment and in a context of low opportunity, in a context of gender dynamics that are maybe not favorable to women, suddenly the choices are really constrained. And so it often makes a lot of sense where poverty and limited access to decent work opportunities, especially for women, means that it's not really a free choice, but it's kind of a form of wage slavery where you have women and men taking up these unsalaried roles who have either an implicit or an explicit desire or paid employment. And they hope that, hey, if I volunteer and I volunteer, that will aid transition into a paid role. And there's this rhetoric often around women's empowerment that's kind of used to provide moral cover for these types of programs that are using female workers as volunteers. But it really downplays that reality, right? That female labor is often cheap in settings with low female literacy, high employment, and these gender norms that disadvantage women. And I think it's really folks, I wrote a little Lancet commentary with Margaret on this topic, and she referenced in that commentary a colleague of hers, and he was a man, but I think he'd worked for like 17 years and just hadn't seen a dime. And I think it's kind of a boiling the frog type of thing. Next week, next year, it's coming and it never comes. And then on the flip side, I think ministries of health are not the baddies here. You know, they are operating also with a huge ton of constraints where they're maybe filling 60% of their health budget with domestic financing, but then they're needing to go and look for resources from global health initiatives or from bilateral funders. And there are those entities create constraints. They might say, hey, we want to make this investment. And the World Bank turns around with them with their neoliberal advice and says, you know, no, cut public sector. You don't expand the public sector. You cut the wage bill. You don't balloon the wage bill. That makes their free choice in many ways. It limits it as well. And so it's a hard situation, but I think that's where something like the policy dashboard is exciting because you can sort of see, hey, you know what? We can actually call someone up in our region in East Africa and say, hey, Malawi next door, like you just did this. how did that happen? Can we talk to your Ministry of Finance? Can we talk to your Ministry of Health? You know, what debt financing, what grants, how did the financial piece come together? How did the policy piece come together? And how can we make this happen? And I think the fact that we're seeing a bunch of secular trends from labor organizing being back on the map in a way that it really hasn't been since like the 20th century, and this becoming more of a women's issue, and health being on the top of people's minds after Ebola and COVID, means that suddenly it's helpful for politicians as well, because it's there's a political demand for it that maybe after many frustrating years of everything staying the same, there hasn't been for some time.
Thank you so much for that, Madeline. And I think you did a beautiful job sort of pointing out the privilege inherent in my first question, right? Which is like, I'm coming from this place where I expect to be paid for my work, and there's so much privilege in that expectation. And so just like helping kind of break down some of those layers. And I think the boiling the frog metaphor is so apt, right? Because you probably get into the work and then there's a stringing along as well. And I think Margaret did a really beautiful job in the previous podcast episode describing that and what that feels like. It also sounds like you see this as like maybe an inflection point moment in sort of things are shifting. Can you tell me a little bit, what do you see like for these countries that are turning purple, right, on this map? And we'll link to the policy dashboard you described, and I was just looking at it. What are some of the things that they're doing well that's enabling them to roll out more advanced policies around CHWs?
Listening to patients. I think so often big changes that we see, and this is where we are learning from, you know, the positive people's movement, HIV movement, where I started and so many did as well, our disability rights movement. Whenever I get asked to speak to these things, I usually say, no, not unless it's a community health worker. And the reason I said yes to this one is like, well, you see, you already talked to, you know, yes, I'm coming after. And I think that that's as it should be, because no one better than the person in the room with the child, with the fever, with the sweat, you know, at night, like knows what's necessary in that moment. And so I think the emergence of key CHW leaders that are active, not only on a national or regional scale, but even on a global scale, is something that we have not seen in the community health space, right? I think there's been, to your question about momentum, there's kind of been enthusiasm for CHWs has come in waves, right? This is not the first time that we've been all hyped up on CHWs. There's the word that barefoot doctors in China during the 50s. There was kind of this post-Alma Ata period, this big conference that took place in the late 70s, where the idea of health for all was first developed and popularized. And that was followed by this big enthusiasm. And then again, in the Millennium Development Goal era, when we realized that we were really short on healthcare workers and we need to do this thing called task shifting in order to reach all the folks that are becoming sick in what was then an out of control HIV pandemic. At all of these times, people are like, oh, community health workers, you know? But I think what's different this time is, unlike the 80s, where if you look up, actually, this is a fun health public health history fact. If you look up the Declaration of Alma Ata, the declaration that talks about how, you know, the world's going to achieve health for all by the year 2000, it's like an 80-page document, and there's one paragraph that talks about financing. So it's like, okay, we're not making that mistake. And there were no community health workers at that meeting. So okay, we're not making that mistake. And so I think with each of these waves, we're learning new things about that triptych of the political will, of the financing, of the good program design, and who used to be in the room to have a productive conversation and set this policy up. And so I think that's why the countries that are kind of purple on that map, and some of them were trailblazers like in Ethiopia, and some of them are more newly purple, but they all kind of have several of those elements in common, where they're looking at the numbers, they're listening to female participation in a meaningful, non-tokenistic way. And then they're taking that best evidence, which has only, again, recently emerged, the WHO's first ever guideline on how to support community health workers, and their work came out in 2018. You know, so this is a century-old story, but it's a story that has really seen a huge number of developments, even since that last wave.
A lot of the points you're making, Madeline, are ones that we often make one level lower at the enablement of CHWs with technology, you know, whether it's a financial argument of better training, more effective work, whether it's a quality of care argument or an access argument. But we've really, at Damagi, aligned on focusing on better jobs, you know, through the work that we've gotten to participate in as a member of SHEIC and just the work we've done in country. We kind of wanted to put a stake in the ground and be like, if we do not focus on improving the jobs of CHWs with technology, among many other things. It's obviously not the only answer. We're never going to serve CHWs correctly, and they're not going to be able to better serve their clients and communities. So much of technology can be extractive. You know, oh, great, we can have CHWs go do our household census. We can have CHWs input what services they're delivering inside my dashboard, even though I'm not using that to do anything. You have a ton of members in the Community Health Impact Coalition that are at the, you know, leading edge of how to use technology to enable CHWs and CHW programs. You have technology partners directly in the CHIC membership. But technology is double-edged. We're taking a thing that could be very helpful and valuable to community healthcare workers, but lots of us have experienced software systems our employer organizations tried to give us that we hated, that were counterproductive to our work. So what, you know, excites you about technology as one component of this journey? And what do you worry about with technology? Because, it's, you know, as you said, we're in one of those waves where it's very popular right now. Lots of national digital health strategies talk about rolling out electronic community health information systems, which is great. But as with everything, you can do it well and you can do it poorly. And it's a challenge given where the fundamental alignment of the value community healthcare workers create may not be aligned to focusing on better jobs or focusing really on the CHW enablement as the end goal. And so I'm just curious to get your opinion and your take, again, given your seat of seeing this across so many countries.
No, I really like the way that you framed that question, Jonathan. I think, yeah, technology, again, holds immense potential. And there's some really sharp double edges there. I think the folks that are doing technology best are folks like Damagi, others within the Community Health Impact Coalition community that you referenced, who understand, first and foremost, that technology is not neutral. It's amazing that folks can still think that sometimes or act with that assumption in this day and age where we know all about algorithmic bias and we know about privacy concerns and we see the way that platformization has reversed, I think, many of the gains that the labor movement has made to the 20th century and still think that the way that we build these systems doesn't have anything to say about whether we're nudging towards more humanizing or more dehumanizing care. So I'd start there. And I think that even this idea that a technology company, or what some folks would call a vendor, which I think is a real undersell of what Damagi does, but you would have an opinion about these things, is novel for a lot of folks. And I don't think it should be, because these are issues that, unless you're being intentional about them, you're just kind of floating down the stream. And you might need to be swimming up current, actually, if you're not wanting to try to recreate some of these harms that we're seeing. So yes, for the pro-CHW movement, the sky's the limit. I think we know all about efficient data management, you know, facilitating remote training, not just for better health outcomes. This idea that we can actually finally have, you know, electronic medical records that can be accessed at any point of care. Like, these dreams are so close to becoming reality and would change care for so many patients and allow providers to see patterns, to correct mistakes, to be able to make better decisions. And I think Damagi's on the leading edge of that. And even within the coalition, we've explored together more like novel and interesting use cases. One stat that we came across during the pandemic is that CHWs with leadership training are 2 to 4 times more likely to engage in political, civic, and workplace advocacy. So, and we know that we talked about the forming National Association CHWs can kind of address some of these power asymmetries that we've talked about, win pro-CHW policy, and then hold governments accountable to deliver that policy and ensure it doesn't get reversed, which is another thing that I think we've seen around the world, that some of these gains that have been achieved through advocacy, they're not permanent. You have to fight for them every day. And so the experience with some of the coalition technology partners of creating something like CHWAdvocates.org, the free digital training tool that equips CHWs with advocacy and storytelling skills, has also been funny and amazing, because we came into this work really thinking about how can technology be improved so that it supports community health workers and their day-to-day work rather than hinders them, as you just said, Jonathan. But we weren't really thinking about how can technology grow this movement to improve working conditions and patient outcomes. And that's what we've seen just over the last 24, 36 months with this course. It's just been a huge funnel where thousands and thousands of CHWs have kind of accessed it through peers, through friends, through family, just on WhatsApp and Fiber, again, other technologies. And then once they're connected, with a leader in the community like Margaret, or maybe it was Margaret that told the truth in the first place. And all of a sudden, understand potentially for many, the first time in their career, like, hey, this is not just a local thing we're facing or a national thing we're facing. There's actually folks next door in my region or globally that are all part of the same story that I'm part of. And now suddenly I have this platform to speak about these issues of concern, not only locally, but nationally and internationally as well. And it's really funny because I think, if you remember the startup thing, but as a community, we're kind of originally thinking through, well, how are we going to take that stat and make advocacy training available to community health workers? Our first thought, because we're just old school people, was, well, we need to do it in person. And then we only pivoted to technology because of COVID. And what a fortuitous pivot, because the scale and speed at which CWs are being connected to the movement would not be possible without technology. So I think it's really exciting. How do we make technology's ability to make community health workers work better and more efficient, make the work of those around community health workers, facility-based workers, data-based decision makers in the Ministry of Health more efficient, and also facilitating the processes of CHWs seizing power through organizing and allowing us to walk with them in that process. So really just incredibly exciting.
I love that anecdote of how technology has helped that advocacy course reach more community healthcare workers, and then the knock-on effects of what that leadership training and that advocacy can do. And one of the things that we're really excited about and have discussed with you and many members of CHIC is also thinking through programs that employ tens of thousands of people at scale are just very difficult to run. It's likely you don't want a completely uniform job description for every single one of those workers, or maybe you want a uniform job description, but how they choose to optimize their time based on the needs of their communities and clients is probably going to be different. The other thing that I think technology, that we've barely scratched the surface of as Damagi, as Medic, as many of the partners of these organizations, is how you combine the top-down support. You know, so what does a national government need to support CHWs at scale? What does a health system design and that level of expertise? But then also, how can technology really empower community healthcare workers and create a bottom-up approach where the CHW has the tools he or she needs primarily to provide the right services in her community. And without technology helping to demonstrate the value, helping to assist in the training, helping to support that care delivery, it's really difficult to imagine how we can unlock that bottom-up approach. But as I look at these programs, and the analogy I give based in the United States, and the analogy I give a lot is with teachers. You know, we do all this national standardization of school curriculum and things, but like communities are so varied across the United States. Like obviously what makes sense in a rich urban area or poor urban area is not the same as a semi-urban or rural area. And the same is true for CHWs. And so the technology empowerment for community healthcare workers, and again, I think we have so far to go on how the software platforms that are used can support this, but to right fit the way technology can support CHWs, which is not with one big top-down design necessarily, but with a top-down strategy, but a bottom-up approach where the CHWs are really empowered to provide the right care based on their local context.
That resonates a lot. And I think the word AI is kind of implicit in your question. And how do we learn in a systematic way about some of those differences across communities and tailor care provision to them is not just a community health issue. It's a health writ large issue globally. And there's so many applications, as you said, just even across fields. And I think I'm so excited to think about what is care going to look like in 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and are we going to achieve the potential of this? And then B, excited in the present tense for how some of these questions that are emerging, as you say, in the current zeitgeist, but how can we undo some of the harms of standardization and provide more tailored care and potentially use AI to do that or other means, are beginning actually to shine a spotlight on kind of some of the longstanding structural violence that undermines those use cases. So I remember precision medicine kind of came onto the scene, or was coming onto the scene prior to the pandemic. And there was actually a group that tried to use AI to improve community health workflow. Like how do we more efficiently target households? But given the limited data available, the algorithm basically came back with, well, every household in this village is poor. Every household has a woman of childbearing age, and every household has children. So it had nothing, you know? And that's in a place where households had at least been like mapped and the community workers had been counted. And that's just so far from where we are. And so when we take seriously the mission of actually, how can we close like the underlying health infrastructure and data gaps, and imagine what's possible when we do that. I think that's a really beautiful story that technologists can tell with public health nerds kind of together and ensure that the fruits of technology that we're seeing in some parts of the world as precision medicine gets embedded into, I don't know, an Apple Watch becomes available to all the world's patients. And I think that's a future that is very much within our grasp in the short term.
And I love that anecdote. And I think there's is so much potential with AI. We recorded an episode a few weeks back. We can link to it in the show notes, but very excited, also somewhat scared. You know, we'll see how all this progress goes. But the point that you raised is so critical in terms of how we will use technology, be it non-AI or AI, that's really relevant to community healthcare workers, right? It doesn't do any good to know that if people are poor, they need care, because a lot of the geography served in a lot of areas that would every household would potentially qualify, depending on what you meant. But really understanding what do CHWs truly need help with? Like, they often know a lot about their communities, a lot about the households. They just need to be paid what they should already be paid to go do that great work and given the supplies. And no fancy AI algorithm is going to change outcomes if we don't fix those underlying concerns. And so I think that is so exciting, but also just some of the basics are going to create such a massive ROI, because you can see it in programs where they are supplied regularly, where they are supervised regularly. You don't need this huge increase in technology to create much better outcomes. And then if you get those baseline factors solved for, then, as you said, the sky's the limit with what you could potentially be doing with technology. But it's got to be coupled with those basic components, again, which is what you mentioned. Often we are sometimes viewed as a vendor, but we have a tagline that we think of ourselves as a partner, not a vendor. And as a partner in creating those better jobs, we know how powerful technology could be, but also how limited its value might be in circumstances where those basics aren't taken care of for community healthcare workers. And so we really view it as one piece of the puzzle. But I totally agree, like, there's a lot of exciting potential. And I like the advocacy that the Gates Foundation is doing, making sure AI is used equitably and funding that they're going to be putting towards that. But the trend of how tech helps workforces like community healthcare workers in countries like those we're targeting, unfortunately, has a very poor track record over the last decade or two of successfully reaching that. So that's something we're going to keep advocating for and directly contributing to. But it's something that I think the global community needs to really be putting effort into, making sure that the immense potential of these technologies reaches this incredibly powerful workforce in the way that's going to really help, as opposed to be extractive.
No, and I think that that's the, you see the difference in the types of questions people are asking. And like, I'll give a shout out to Damagi here. You know, I think because you're listening and allying yourselves with health workers, the question that you asked with the latest, you know, some of the work that you're doing around ComCare and some of the newest releases, you know, the question you're asking is not how do we try to make a better precision care algorithm with limited data than the one that's already in the community health worker's head, because we need several more years of data to do that. If you've talked to any community health worker, they'll say, oh, this person's expecting men, that person has, you know, measles, like, yes, that kid has, they are a precision care machine already. That's not the problem that they need help with. And I think it's through talking to health workers that then Damagi was able to sort of say, well, what is the problem that we need help with? It's making that work visible and tracking it. I think that that's sort of some of the things that you're looking at with some of the work that you're doing. And so rather than asking who's asking the question, and rather than trying to solve a problem that may not be a problem on this scale or in this context, can we solve a problem that certainly is, and slot technology in there? And so just, you know, how we're even approaching the issue, I think, really dictates the success of the failure that we see. It's really nifty to tell both those stories side by side, of, you know, one being about trying to replicate something that already exists in CHW's brain, and one being about how to create a visibility and a dignity and respect for their labor that wasn't previously there. And those are two very different and probably equally technically complex, but potentially one more interesting than the other applications of quote-unquote technology.
Madeline, in our last minute together, tell us a little bit about where you're going from here, and maybe built into that, what is the number one takeaway you want our audience to walk away from this conversation with?
Yeah, we're turning the dashboard purple. More research, more advocacy, more activating national CHW networks all the time, everywhere, with CHWs leading the charge. You know, nothing about CHWs without CHWs until professional CHWs are the norm. And so if there's one thing that we would love listeners to take away from this is please join us. There is a role for you, whether you're a digital technology partner, whether you're a healthcare worker, whether you're a funder, an implementer, a policymaker. This is a big issue where everybody can play a role. And folks have already gathered around some momentum towards solving this issue and creating a world with care for everyone. And sustained collaboration is how we win. And so if we can be together, have our voices be stronger, have our resources go further, and ultimately do more for patients, then I think we're going to win. So yeah, join us.
I love that. Thank you so much, Madeline.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you so much to Dr. Madeline Ballard for joining us today. I'm going to share my top takeaways, but there's so much in here, so I definitely recommend listening to this episode again. The biggest thing I take from this is that we need to cover the basics first. We need to get community health workers professionalized. I love the memorable 4S framework that Dr. Ballard offers. CHWs need to be salaried, skilled, supervised, and supplied. Once we get there, next-gen technology can take it to the next level. But at this very moment, it's not AI that's needed. Community health workers have the ultimate intelligence. What we need to do is first unleash their intelligence by properly supporting them before we should even be thinking about rolling out the perfect AI algorithm to make them more effective. This isn't to say that we shouldn't also be thinking about the role of AI. We should be, but it's so important to get this foundation in first. I also wanted to reemphasize John's point. The community health worker model empowers individuals within their communities, which challenges this rising trend of healthcare becoming more and more transactional. By supporting and enabling community-based health advocates, we can create a real shift in how healthcare works and make it more personal and human. I also appreciated Dr. Ballard's clear message to technologists. Technology is not neutral. You have to be intentional about how technology is used if you want to avoid creating harm or becoming extractive. In Damagi's case, this is something we think about and talk about a lot when it comes to creating tools for health workers. A job aid for a health worker can easily become an extractive data collection only tool, where we're asking health workers to get a long list of data that interrupts the flow of their job and actually makes their job harder versus a supportive tool. And we have to be mindful here. I also want to highlight what Dr. Ballard shared around how technology can not only make jobs better as a thoughtful job aid, it can also connect and amplify important movements. As we've seen with community health workers who are taking an advocacy course and being able to better speak up and advocate for themselves and their communities, which is so essential. And you heard from Dr. Ballard how important it is that we are continually fighting to maintain gains that we've earned through advocacy. The last thing I want to elevate from this conversation is really distilling down what we heard from Dr. Ballard around the work that Sheik is doing to turn the Sheik policy dashboard purple, as Dr. Ballard describes. Currently, only 34 of the 137 countries that Sheik is following are paying and accrediting community health workers. One of those 34 is Ethiopia. And actually, in a future episode, we're going to hear in more detail about some of the work that's happening there and all of the effort and thought and investment that's had to go into it. And if we look at the countries that are leading in this movement to professionalize community health workers, Dr. Ballard shares a few key things that they're doing right. They've got strong political will. They're willing to listen to female community health workers. I love this point that Dr. Ballard makes. She said, "If you're not at the table, you're on the menu," which is just so apt and describes her approach for doing nothing about CHWs without CHWs involved. Community health workers need to be in the room contributing to the program design. Countries also need to be thinking through the financing to support a salaried community health worker program, something that funders need to support as well. And lastly, they need to be reviewing and continuously applying the evidence to improve. So if you're inspired by today's conversation, check out Sheik at joinsheik.org. That's joinchic.org. That's our show. Please like, rate, review, subscribe, and share this episode if you found it useful. It really helps us grow our impact. And write to us at podcast@damagi.com with any ideas, comments, or feedback. This show is executive produced by myself. Danielle Sheldon is our producer. Sarah Strauss is our editor. And cover art is by Sudhanshu Khan. Thank you.